we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
If you decide to challenge America's experiment in democracy, it's going to be your worst day. Those were the words of the US Defense Secretary as he unveiled America's new defense strategy, which will now primarily focus on deterring Russia and China.
We face growing threats from revisionist powers as different as China and Russia are from each other. Nations that do seek to create a world consistent with their authoritarian models, pursuing veto authority over other nations' economic, diplomatic, and security decisions.
The Defense Secretary Gavin Williamson has warned that Russia could cause thousands and thousands of deaths and create total chaos in Britain.
What they're looking at doing is they're going to be thinking, how can we just cause so much pain to Britain, damage its economy, rip its infrastructure apart, actually cause thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths, but actually have an element of creating total chaos within the country.
A new Cold War has been openly declared by Washington and its allies against Russia and China. US Defense Secretary James Mattis's January 18th speech at Johns Hopkins University outlining the Trump administration's defense strategy leaves no doubt of it. Compounded by his UK counterpart Gavin Williamson's speech in London soon afterwards, in which he claimed that Russia poses a direct threat to the security of the British people. Now, I would stake my life on the assumption that there is hardly a single person going about their business today in London, Paris, New York, or any other city throughout the West who believes that their lives or the lives of their families and loved ones are under threat of an imminent attack from Russia. I really would stake my life on that. Conversely, I do think it's fair to say that many of us, while going about our business in these and other cities in the West, do so with the knowledge in the back of our minds that it is perfectly conceivable that a terrorist attack may occur. This given the spate of attacks that have occurred throughout the West in recent times. And yet we are expected to believe that Russia, the country which out with the Middle East has played the most decisive and effective role in combating terrorism, is our enemy? We are expected to believe that the country whose armed forces liberated Auschwitz, the epicentre of the Nazi Holocaust in Europe, 73 years ago, is now the fount of evil in our world, despite the fact it is no longer a communist country? How absurd is it that we currently have NATO troops, aircraft and naval assets deployed in Eastern Europe ready to go to war with Russia, while Russian troops and aircraft and naval assets are in Syria combating terrorism? The same terrorism that threatens people in our countries. This doesn't make any sense at all. Or does it? George Kennan, the famed US State Department Mandarin credited with devising the policy of containment which underpinned Washington's stance towards Moscow for most of the Cold War, was never more honest than when he opined, and I quote, "Were the Soviet Union to sink tomorrow under the waters of the ocean, the US military industrial establishment would have to go on, substantially unchanged, until some other adversary could be invented. Anything else would be an unacceptable shock to the American economy." Given that the Trump administration is to increase the already gargantuan US defense budget to $719 billion in 2019, the economic imperatives outlined in Kennan's quote is self-evident. What we need to understand, though, when discussing this question is it is not one concerned with advancing democracy, neither is it about human rights nor security. It is fundamentally a question of imperialism, which in its broadest sense is the ideology of domination. In the West, we live under a status quo that can best and most easily be summed up as class oppression at home and imperialism abroad. Both are inextricably linked in a circular relationship outlined by Malcolm X when he said, "You can't understand what's going on in Mississippi if you don't understand what's going on in the Congo." I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, George Samouli is an author, he's an academic, and he's a geopolitical analyst, and he joins me now on the line from New York. George, thanks for coming on the show.
Good, thank you for being here.
Now, I mean, James Mattis's speech, I've scoured the records. It is beyond any shadow of a doubt the most inflammatory speech of any US defence secretary since the end of the First Cold War, compounded, as I said in my introduction, by the speech given by his UK counterpart, Gavin Williams. The two are obviously linked. Gavin Williamson was playing the accustomed role of the loyal vassal when he was responding to James Mattis's speech, and he was aligning UK foreign policy with Washington's foreign policy in, as I say, the accustomed manner. What did you make of James Mattis's speech? What were your main takeaways?
Well, that it is extraordinary belligerence. Belligerence that we didn't have even during the Cold War, because if you recall the Cold War, for most of it, other than perhaps during the earliest years, for most of it, the emphasis on the part of political leaders was on détente, on attempting to improve relations with the Soviet Union. There was extensive arms control negotiations. And in particular, after the scare of the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a great deal of pressure on the Western political leaders to calm the fears of the public, that they're not going to do anything crazy, that there's not going to be a war between the superpowers, and that what they really need to do is to improve relations, to bring arms to under control, and not to get themselves again, as they did in Cuba, into a serious confrontation. This now, we're going to the opposite direction. Now we're having political leaders that are going out of their way to provoke a conflict, to seek to engage in some sort of an armed confrontation with Russia, and even talking about possible limited nuclear exchanges, winning a war with Russia. It is an extremely dangerous time because the political leaders are not acting with any of the caution that the political leaders of the Cold War were doing.
Now, you made a very good point, and you touched on something which I think is absolutely fundamental to trying to understand where we are. You said for most of the Cold War, the Western leaders believed in détente, but that changed, didn't it, under Reagan, under the Reagan administration? It went from détente to a sort of front foot forward policy where they thought they could actually win the Cold War. And they did this, they thought, by pitching the then Soviet Union into an unwinnable arms race, and thus creating the crisis and helping to create the crisis and the economic crisis in the Soviet Union, which led to all the contradictions, which ultimately, as we know, led to its eventual demise. Now, we know that Trump has cited Reagan as his model of a great president. And we know that Reagan is the kind of template of a great president in the eyes of the Republican Party at large. Do you see something of that strategy, that they're trying to pitch China and Russia into some kind of unwinnable arms race?
I think that's a very good analogy. That's exactly what the Reagan administration was engaged in and what Trump seems to be doing. So just in the same way, Reagan was increasing belligerence in all parts of the world, in Central America, in Afghanistan, in the Middle East. I mean, everywhere, Reagan was simply stoking up in the intensification of the Cold War. And Trump seems to be doing the same thing. However, one ought to say that Reagan then did change his policy and changed the policy very significantly in 1985 when there was a change in the leadership in Moscow. And despite the fact that he was came under quite strong criticism from within his own party.
This is when Mikhail Gorbachev assumed the leadership.
When Mikhail Gorbachev took over in Moscow. And despite the strong criticism from the neoconservatives who were very powerfully embedded within the Reagan administration and outside, and his own Republican Party, who were highly critical of Reagan's détente policy, Reagan persevered and signed very extensive arms control agreements, the very arms control agreements that now the Trump administration is hell-bent on reneging on, namely the INF Treaty, which seems to be history. And after that, probably the START treaties as well, which are also going to be history. So, yes, there was a very belligerent stance in the early years of the Reagan administration, but he did see an opportunity, and he did change his policy following the advent of to power of Gorbachev.
Now, you're absolutely spot on with that, George. That's right. Reagan did warm to Gorbachev. He wanted to help Gorbachev affect the reforms that he wanted to bring in and introduce. We know the story that Gorbachev was naive because there were certain guarantees, verbal guarantees about NATO's eastward expansion upon the reunification of Germany that were not upheld. We know the story there, and that's helped to feed the ire of Moscow ever since, and justifiably so.
Yes.
Counterintuitively, though, George, do you think this is actually a symptom of US decline? This inflammatory speech and this pledge to exponentially increase the already gargantuan, as I describe, US defence budget, which currently is already much greater than the defence budgets of every other advanced economy combined. Do you think this is a sign of desperation? Russia's re-emergence strategically and geopolitically, China's ongoing economic growth, and that they're worried that they're losing a grip in the Middle East. They're no longer the hegemonic power that they were when it comes to all these different parts of the world. Do you see anything in that? Or do you think I'm overstating the case? Because we do know that when the Roman Empire was on its dying days, and when I say days, I'm speaking figuratively. We measure days in historical context, and, you know, in centuries and so forth. But I'm talking about the fact that the US is no longer the great power that it was. It's no longer the sole superpower. Russia has recovered from the 90s, and it's now a strong geopolitical and strategic counterweight.
I think that's right. That what has happened over the last, 15 or so years, it has been the reemergence of Russia. But Russia now as a kind of a leader of a geopolitical coalition. I mean, you know, Russia is not like the USSR. The USSR was in a position to challenge the United States' global hegemony. But Russia just isn't a power on that scale. But Russia has been playing its hands very shrewdly, and it's built a coalition of powers who are all interested in a plurality of power sources in the world. They don't like a world in which everything is determined by the United States, by NATO, by the Western powers, whether the financial system, the military system, the economic system. So everything is concentrated within these few Western powers. So Russia has quietly but firmly challenged that. And the United States has sensed this. So while they have the Russian military power, there's the behind the Russian military power, there's the Chinese economic and financial power. So it's much harder now to bully countries than it was before, because, you know, countries such as Venezuela can now go, if the banks and the IMF turn their back on Venezuela, Venezuela can now go to the Chinese and to the Russians and ask for loans. This wasn't possible before. So then now there is a diverse path for going forward for a number of other countries. This is, I think, infuriating the United States. And that's why I think the United States policy is now to cause as much chaos as possible to prevent any kind of order emerging or any solution to problems other than under U.S. auspices. So that's why what we have now in Syria is the absolute determination of the United States to prevent any possible settlement, any possible resolution of the conflict. That's all the U.S. policy is devoted to. Same in the Ukraine. I mean, United States policy is to ensure that the conflict and the chaos and the destruction continues forever, because it seemed to weaken other powers. The more chaos, the more other powers are weakened. So I do think that underlying it is a fear that the United States cannot create an order of its own. It doesn't have the power, the resources any longer. So therefore, it must seek to destroy other sources of power.
So it's a policy of maximum disruption.
Yes.
To try and regain the stability that it once enjoyed under its own tutelage. Now, we've come up to the break, George. After the break, I'd like to get into what Russia and China's response should be. You're listening to George Samueli. This is Hard Facts. We'll be right back.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting down with author, academic and geopolitical analyst George Samuele, and we are discussing the inflammatory and extraordinary speech that was delivered by US Defense Secretary James Mattis at Johns Hopkins University on January the 18th, outlining the Trump administration's defense strategy, which was compounded by a speech delivered in London by his UK counterpart, Gavin Williamson, fast on its heels, which sought to frighten, I think that's a fair assessment, the British people into believing that Russia is their enemy. Now, George, I don't know what the response in Moscow to this would be. It's clearly a very, very serious step change. It's an uprating. It's a deepening of the intensity of the tensions that Russia has been trying to ameliorate. Putin and his team clearly put some hopes. I don't think they were naive enough to put all their hopes, but some hopes in the warm statements that Trump was making during his election campaign in 2016 about reorienting US foreign policy away from conflicts abroad and resetting relations with Moscow and seeking partnership in the common fight against terrorism. And many people were encouraged by that. I was one of them. That's all changed. Regardless of the whys and wherefores, whether Trump is forced to do this, whether the deep state has managed to get him in his clutches and he's doing this against his will, I don't think we can dance on the head of that pin. Now, the difference when it comes to what Russia's response and China's response should be, George, is I'm sure you will know and be very well aware of, is that today we do not have a Sino-Soviet split. We do not have a split between the two communist powers that was a factor in the 1950s, 60s and 70s, in which the Americans under the Nixon administration were able to cleverly and astutely exploit at the behest of one Dr. Henry Kissinger. This surely must push Russia and China much, much closer together, shouldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the Russian-Chinese alliance is very firmly established because they both have a strong interest in preventing this global U.S. hegemony. And it's an alliance in which the Russians lend their enormous military power as well as their diplomatic skills. So because, you know, I think the Russians are used to using their diplomatic skills at the various different global forums. They learned how to do this during the Cold War, and then they're using it very skillfully today. And so combine that with the Chinese economic and financial power, that I think is a formidable alliance. Clearly, this is something that strongly displeases the United States. And it seems like the strategy is to pick off Russia. I think that they feel that if they can provoke Russia into doing something foolish, into isolating itself, into getting itself into some awful conflict, you know, such as the one they got themselves into in the 1980s in Afghanistan, if they can do that, then that will weaken this Russian-Chinese alliance. So that's why the Trump administration and all the Democrats are focusing so much on Russia. It's Russia that they want to get at.
Now, regarding Putin's strategy, there's a huge amount of misconception when it comes to Vladimir Putin and his intentions. Most of it is fabricated for political purposes, but it is a fact. You'll know yourself in the States, it's the same here in the UK. You go into any bookstore today and there's a cottage industry has emerged on the back of these anti-Putin books and anti-Russian books and with lurid titles about Russia strongman and, you know, Putin the dictator and so on. And so Who Lost Russia by Peter Conradi. But even Peter Conradi admits that when Putin first emerged at the top of Russian politics in the late 1990s, early 2000s, he was prime minister in 1999 and he was appointed president by Yeltsin before his departure in 2000. And he won the election that year and therefore his mandate was solidified. That in his first meeting with any Western political leader was with Lord Robertson, George Robertson, who was then the head of NATO, the NATO's Secretary General. And Putin asked him if Russia could join the West. And Putin also asked if Russia would ever be able to join NATO. And so this is a product of their recklessness that upon the demise of the Soviet Union, they felt that they had won the Cold War, which is not factually true, and that it was now time to impose a Carthaginian peace via the imposition of free market shock treatment and to turn Russia into a wholly owned subsidiary of Washington. They could not conceive of a multipolar world in which Russia would be able to join the family of nations in a way that would help foment stability and peace and so forth. And this goes back to this George Kennan quote. I really don't think we can understate the economic imperatives behind this, not in the realms of conspiracy theory, but just cold, hard facts when it comes to the motor force of the US economy. How can this be changed? How can this monster, this juggernaut, which is US imperialism, I suspect it can only be changed from within, George. There must be some kind of internal social shock given the nature of the polarization and the inequality in the States. What's your prognosis?
Well, I think that's right. It's hard to see how it can be changed other than through some sort of a domestic crisis. But you're just going back to the point you made about Putin. I mean, everything you said is highly significant, because Putin's mandate was, when he became prime minister, was to help recover the Russian economy. I mean, Russia had become very weak, and it was an attempt to bring the economy under its control, bring the oligarchs under control. So he was completely focused on domestic issues. The last thing he wanted was any kind of bad relations with the West, because on the contrary, he needed Western help. He needed Western investment. And it is very significant that after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, he immediately told George W. Bush that Russia is with you, we're going to do everything we can to help you.
He absolutely did. You're absolutely, sorry, George, this needs to be stressed. He absolutely did. And he helped when it came to the military operation in Afghanistan, didn't he?
That's right. That's exactly right. He helped to get American troops into Afghanistan and all of that. And what was his payback? His payback was the Bush administration's support for the various jihadis in Chechnya and the Bush administration's withdrawal from the ABM treaty, which was the great pillar of the arms control agreements of the detente era. So that was his reward for lending his full throat of support for the George Bush's global war on terror. And so that is the case. Now, what was the strategy? You're absolutely right. The strategy from the 1990s on was to break up Russia. Right? Russia is a multinational, multi-confessional federation. And the goal was to break it up into these tiny statelets that will become wholly owned subsidiaries of the various multinational corporations. You know, so it'll be kind of like the Gulf states writ large, you know, these tiny little states that would have no power at all vis-a-vis the multinational corporations. And that will be that. That will be that. Russia's natural resources would just simply be controlled by the West, and Russia would just simply disappear effectively as a any kind of a great power. That was the agenda. That is still the agenda. And so Russia really has to resist that very strongly, because that is all that the West really wants. I mean, that we've seen this since the end of the Cold War, that has been the Western agenda, to break up the Russian Federation, bring its natural resources under the West control, and just, you know, minimize Russia. How this changes, going back to what we were talking about, I agree that it's only through some kind of some domestic crisis, such as the one that we had in 2008. It seemed like there'd be a major change under Obama. That didn't happen. I thought briefly that there might be a major change under Trump. That didn't happen. So, I don't know.
George, can I just push you on this Trump thing? Why do you think the change did not happen? Do you think it was a deep state? Do you think that Trump's responding to the pressure that's been exerted against him vis-a-vis Russiagate and the liberal establishment rage over the fact that their president-in-waiting, Hillary Clinton, lost the election?
I do think that was probably the key factor in all of this. Trump had figured out quite early on that he is likely to be impeached when the Democrats regain control of the House. And he's impeachment is pretty much a certainty. He really needs all the Republican votes he can get in order to survive an impeachment trial in the Senate. And I think that he really cannot go against the Republicans, because the Republicans are as crazy about Russia as the Democrats. So he really couldn't do the bold thing and say, hey, I won the election. I ran on a platform of seeking to improve relations with Russia. I will now carry out the policy that I promised during the election, because the Republicans would have gone crazy. And he'd be guaranteed that he would lose any kind of an impeachment trial in the Senate. So I do think that what the Democrats did, they absolutely petrified him, and he just caved almost immediately.
Where is the political opposition to this madness, George, in Washington? Is there any? I mean, this network of neocon think tanks that run right through the West, there's more and more of them. You know, they have very murky relationships with all kinds of very murky funders and sponsors and corporations and so on. They're playing an onerous role in creating this mood music, this anti-Russian mood music. And yet it's Russian media that's demonized. Russian media is a problem. Russian media is, you know, Russian media in the US, Sputnik and RT have been forced to register as foreign agent. You're right, this is unprecedented. This goes beyond anything that we saw during the Cold War. This is beyond neo-McCarthyism. We are at war right now. This is war.
That's it. That's exactly right. I mean, that's why some statement like the one made by Gavin Williamson the other day, had he said this during the Cold War, he would have been attacked. He would have been attacked by the media. He would have been attacked by politicians saying that this is reckless, irresponsible, inflammatory talk. And, you know, you have no business, trying to terrify people. You have no business inciting any kind of a war, looking forward to a war. And today, this seems to be normal. I mean, it says, okay, fine, you know, Russians will kill thousands and thousands of people. You know, no one seems to object to it.
And you made something, George, sorry to interrupt because we're running out of time, unfortunately. The mainstream media are cheerleading this. They're not challenging. They're not holding the politicians and the political leadership to account. They're actually beating the drum for war, despite what happened in 2003 in Iraq, despite the destruction of Libya, despite what happened in the Balkans in the 1990s.
Yes.
This seems to be a moral sickness that has the whole U.S. political and media establishment in its grip.
Yes, exactly right. It is a sickness. I mean, the media and that very kind of policy-making elite, they're all together on this. And there's a lot of money now splashing around. In other words, there's some, you know, the Obama administration in its last days allocated millions and millions of dollars to what they call countering Russian propaganda. So now there is all this money splashing around, and so people have every incentive to come up with all kinds of new ideas about Russian propaganda, Russian influence, Russian operations, Russian hybrid warfare, because that's how you get money from the government. And so and the media are just they're continually fueling this fire. I mean, can one imagine at any time during the Cold War, where the media and the policymakers would be advocating confronting Russia in Ukraine? I mean, cannot imagine anything as absolutely insane as that, knowing how the Russians feel about Ukraine, knowing that this is an absolute red line for them, and to go in there and to send in lethal weaponry, thinking, oh, well, that'll show the Russians. I mean, it is the most irresponsible, outrageous thing that's been happened in the West for, you know, many decades.
You've been listening to George Samueli. I'm John White. Until next time, remember, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.